every day he does it with these people.
You can say with confidence you think Karen Reed killed John O'Keefe.
She admitted it.
Karen Reed, his longtime girlfriend, was charged with second-degree murder. So why does this case interest me, Mark, and why do I want to talk about it? According to people in the house, he never makes it in the house, and she drives away. And, you know, there's evidence that they had a fiery relationship.
He may have manipulated evidence. He may have not been completely truthful on the stand. This is where mistrust of law enforcement happens. It's not so much at the rank and file level when cops screw up and the cops do screw up. It's when you find out that an agency is either encouraging this type of behavior or they are allowing this type of behavior. Either one leads to mistrust in law enforcement. In this case, mistrust in the private investigator.
Chief Mark Garrett, what's happening?
Oh, I'm not sure because... you're at the helm over there. And
yeah,
so
sometimes
anyway.
I just hit record, man. And if you're talking about something, you better either shut up or be willing for it to be public. I hope your foot's okay. Let's start with that.
Well, once I pulled it out of my mouth, it seems to be much better now.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Mark, we're going to talk about a murder today. You know, January 29th, 2022, John O'Keefe, a Boston police officer, was found bruised and battered in the snow outside the residence of Brian Albert, also a Boston police officer. And eventually, some amount of time later, I think not much, maybe days, weeks, Karen Reed, his longtime girlfriend, was charged with second-degree murder. So why does this case interest me, Mark, and why do I want to talk about it? It was a long trial. You know, anytime there's a second, she was charged with second degree murder, among other charges. It was like an 8-week trial, which I don't know, maybe you know better than me if that's really long in murder terms. Probably not. But it was a significant second degree murder trial. It ended in a mistrial. And so people know, you know, the word mistrial is maybe a little bit deceiving. Mistrial makes it seem almost like that there was a procedural error or something wasn't done right at the trial. And I mean, technically, I guess you could say that's true, but the reality is it was a hung jury. That's what the issue was. And I wanted to talk about this case because I want to give you my thoughts, but I want to hear what you think. Did the gender of the victim and the suspect have an impact on the jury's lack of a verdict in this case? That's number one. And number two, what influence did the victim's occupation, he was, as I said, a Boston police officer. What influence did his occupation have on the verdict? So I guess the best place to start, Mark, is kind of talking about the characters and the timeline of what happened, and then we'll get into some of the really interesting or strange allegations that have been made about this case or about this murder. January 8th, 2022, John O'Keefe, the victim, Karen Reed, the suspect who's now stood trial and, you know, got the no verdict. They go out drinking at a couple bars with friends. And at least a couple of the people with them are Chris Albert, John's brother, who's I think he referred to him as like a city councilman or something. I don't know exactly what the term was they used, right?
Yeah, something like that.
And Brian Albert and Brian's sister-in-law, Jen McCabe. So basically family and friends, they're out at bars drinking. After midnight, John O'Keefe and the crew decide to go to Brian Albert's home. And they're going to have kind of an after party there. It's a snowstorm. They drive over there. Karen Reed drives John O'Keefe over there. There's only two of them in the car, Lexus SUV. He gets out of the car. That's not in contention, but he never makes it in the house, and she drives away. So it's kind of that, you know, according to people in the house, he never makes it in the house, and she drives away. And this is where kind of the different theories of the crime get a little crazy. So she goes home. Karen Reed goes home. She's staying with O'Keefe at his house and, you know, calls him a lot and texts him a lot that night. I want to say there was like 50 phone calls or 50 text messages to him. They weren't answered. In the morning, and it's early in the morning, Mark, I don't know if you know the exact time, but she decides to go look for him. A.m. I think it was maybe 4 or 5 a.m.
You're right. It was just before daybreak, I believe. Yes.
Yeah. So before daybreak, she wakes up. She hasn't heard from him. He's not in the house. And she gets in the car. Now, there's apparently a blizzard going on. This is March in, you know, suburbs of Boston, Canton, Massachusetts. She goes out to look for him with a couple other women. And she finds him in at the house where she dropped him off. She finds him basically, I'm going to say, in the front yard, Mark, or were they real clear about exactly where he was found? Like, was it in the street? Was it in a snowbank?
Yeah, wondering, it seemed to me like it was actually in the front yard, because he said there was a, you know, a snow drift or lots of snow there. But I was kind of confused too. I wasn't sure exactly where, but it seems like he was in the outer front yard or maybe just in the street.
Right. So this is what the prosecution contends, Mark. This is what, you know, the basis of the charges when Karen Reed was charged with murder. And man, this tour, it's almost like this town of Canton, which is another interesting aspect of this case. And these cases happen, right? These cases happen over the years where they're just incredibly polarizing. You're either on one side or the other. And sometimes you don't even mention what your view is because you're afraid of damaging relationships or, you know, friendships or whatever. But here's what the prosecution says happened. They said the couple got into an argument and, you know, there's evidence that they had a fiery relationship. And after dropping off O'Keefe, the prosecution says that Reed reversed the car and hit him. And that the next morning when she, with her friends, had found him in the snow, by the way, he was dead. I mean, they transported him to the hospital, but he was declared dead. The next morning when she found him, she supposedly told her friends, I hit him.
She, right? Yeah. Now I read a quote where she's saying a number of times, I hope I didn't hit him. That was correct. A quote that I read, but, they're very similar.
No, that is true. She told her friends, I hope I didn't hit him. I hope he didn't get hit by a snowplow. And, you know, also she apparently, or someone that was with her, did a search for how long, how long you live with cold exposure,
cold.
How long to die. Yeah. What was it?
Yeah. How long do you live in the cold, or how long to die in the cold?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the paramedics who were there the next morning, they reported that she made some statement to the effect that I hit him, whether it was in a question form, whether it was in a statement form. I mean, that's, you know, contended. People who were inside the house said that he never made it inside. Now, Reed's vehicle had a broken taillight and pieces of it were found outside this home. And I'm going to go back and talk about that later because that's pretty significant. But this is what I wanted to ask you from back in your CHP days. The prosecution says data from the vehicle's, quote, internal system, unquote, indicated she reversed at a high rate of speed, specifically 24.2 miles per hour, for 62.5 feet. And the prosecution says that she knocked him down and it was blunt force trauma, and then he froze to death or died of exposure. What are we talking about here with the vehicle systems? Is it like computer data, logging computer data? Do you have any experience with the highway patrol with ever getting information? Yeah,
I have ancillary experience because there are two things here. You know, since I left and certainly since I was investigating traffic accidents, which is a long time ago now, you know, 20 plus years ago before I got out of that job and went into supervising and management, I didn't personally deal with that because the technology was not then what it is now. The other part of that is the people in the highway patrol who deal with that, they're officers, but they get a much higher level of training. They go back to the academy and they go through, I can't even begin to explain to you the levels of training they go through. In other words, you pass one class, you go back to the field, you have to apply for and go back to another class. And these are step after step after step before you're certified the highest level with this type of forensic investigation. So these officers are really, we call them the nerds of the highway patrol because they are the guys who have the pocket protectors. These guys come into the department with physics degrees and engineering degrees. They're very, very, very bright people, way above my level. Now, when I say ancillary, I'm aware of it because I had officers working for me who did this, and they would brief me on information they've downloaded and they've examined what conclusions they've come to. So the information is extremely valuable. It's very, very accurate. It's not encompassing. It doesn't solve every mystery, but it's a fantastic tool. Now, again, it's similar to a black box. It's not a black box. It's software, but it's a similar how to use. You download it. Most of it's proprietary. We have to have agreements with the various vehicle manufacturers. They actually give law enforcement access to these devices and these systems to download the information. So it's not just anybody can go plug it in and look at it. So with all that said, I do want to talk about that 24 mile an hour reverse for that amount of time. Probably not a lot of people have ever driven a car backwards, you know, in reverse at 24 miles an hour for any length of time. I have, and a lot faster, by the way, in training that I've done, and in car racing and go out there and have fun. Driving a car 24 miles an hour backwards for 10, 15, 20 seconds, whatever, that is a long, long time. And that's a fairly high rate of speed. And it requires a little bit of practice and agility to keep a car in a straight line. My point is this, it's not something that people normally do.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that, man. I agree with that. So here's what, and here's her defense. I guess that's the next thing to talk about is her defense. And remember, John O'Keefe, the man who was killed, a Boston police officer, and this happened outside the house of another Boston police officer. She says that the off-duty police inside the house attending the party, she says O'Keefe went in the house and that he was beaten and killed inside the house, and they dragged him outside and dumped him on the lawn and then conspired to frame her for this murder, and that the police fabricated evidence and lied under oath to protect their own. So that's, remember earlier, Mark, I talked about whether, my belief that the occupation of the victim had an impact on this trial. And this is what I was talking about. And even the jury's statement, Mark, what was it? When the jury couldn't come up with, they said the this is when they couldn't reach a verdict, right? They said the divergence in our views are not rooted in a lack of understanding or effort, but deeply held convictions that each of us carry, ultimately leading to a point where consensus is unattainable. And when I heard that, I couldn't help but think, is this the new world we live in where people have these deeply held beliefs that law enforcement is unethical, or they are going to protect their own and fabricate evidence and lie under oath to protect their own? And I'm wondering, if that played some role in this. The other thing is, I mean, if it happened the way the prosecution alleges, domestic violence, it's a domestic violence case, unless it was an accident. But like you said, Mark, 20 miles an hour in reverse for that length of time, that's, it doesn't sound, based on the evidence that was presented, that seems very factual, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's open to interpretation. It looks like they had a fiery relationship. They were in an argument and it was purposeful, right? She says that, it's a police cover-up, and it started when the defense attorney got a call on the day of the arraignment, and basically he was told, your client is innocent. The victim, this is according to the defense attorney, he says that he was told the victim was beaten up by Brian Albert and his nephew. They broke his nose, and when he didn't come to, Brian and a federal agent dumped his body outside. Now, I don't know how much sense that makes, Mark. If you're going to do a murder and you want to cover it up, you dump the body in your own front yard. Talk to me about I guess all three things: the role that you think occupation might have played and how people look at police and police behavior now, the genders, a female suspect alleged to have killed a male victim in a domestic violence incident. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot to unpack, and I'll try to be brief here. first of all, this is just me speaking. The gender aspect of it here doesn't really have much impact on me. I think circumstances are much more impactful than the gender in this case. I think if we had a racial issue here in today's environment, today's culture, that would be a lot more impactful. But the gender aspect of here doesn't really have, it doesn't really impress me much either way. That's number one. Number two, the phone call to the defense attorney, that is about as meaningful to me as what time of day it was when he got the phone call. The reason is because, first of all, it's not admissible. Number two, we have no idea who this person was. Number three, we're not sure that the defense attorney is being totally honest. Maybe he is. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's not. I have no idea. But it's a complete throwaway because, kind of fast forwarding here, we're talking about the mistrial with the respective parties here, the two camps saying that we're entrenched, and the response to the judge is that because of our basically our philosophical position. So, in other words, we just don't have anything concrete here about the facts as far as we know from the jury. It all goes back to their philosophies, things like this. Now here's where I'm concerned, and I have a question here. How did these people, and by the way, we don't know which side of which campus is saying that because of our personal beliefs, we can't convict or we can't quit. Not sure which way this went, right? So I'm not accusing anybody here being pro-cop or anti-cop because we don't know who these people are. But theoretically, they should have been vetted. Now, again, we know this has always happened because, again, after the OJ verdict, we had jurors that said, I was not going to convict him as payback for what happened to Rodney King. So people always look at the cracks in juries, but now we have a whole camp here, like I think it was 6-6 or whatever it was, that's saying they pretty much had already been predetermined. We're going to convict or we're going to acquit based on our personal beliefs. So it slipped through the cracks right there with the vetting process for jury selection. Number two, it is a very, very dark time when we have jurors that admit, basically, from what I read in that correspondence, that we were not going to do X or Z or whatever it is based on the evidence. We were going to do one or the other based on how we feel. Mm-hmm. That's bad.
Yeah. So, Mark, you don't think if this is a female victim and a male suspect that the outcome's different?
Well,
given everything else the same.
Yeah. It may have been different. I just don't know. The reason I don't know is because of where I finished up there about these jurors saying that we are entrenched because of our underlying beliefs. And so I don't know what those are, Bill. I don't know what those are. And so let's say it had been a male civilian and a female cop. Well, if you have a whole bunch of cop haters there, they were going to convict. I mean, they were going to acquit no matter what, right? Because we don't know what their underlying philosophies and beliefs and convictions are. So I just, I want to be honest here. I don't have an answer as to or an opinion, quite frankly, of if it would have made a difference. I guess if I had to roll the dice, anytime you have a female victim, I could see it being maybe a jury being more sympathetic. It's probably likely, but I just don't know for sure. And by the way, I do want to finish about a conspiracy theory, like you said, about, first of all, why? I didn't read anything in the few articles that I read about any explanation or theory as to why these officers and other people will conspire to kill this person and then cover it up and then frame an innocent person. No one even throws out a theory as to why this would happen. So, in other words, they might as well throw out a theory that you and I committed the murder and then flew back home the next day, because that will have as much weight with me as what they're saying right now. There's absolutely no explanation or there's no theory as to why anybody would engage in such a conspiracy.
Right. So, So let's talk about some of the, let's call them unfavorable facts, right? And maybe after this, we can say, hey, is this what the jury's hanging their hat on? Or is this what the jury didn't like about the case? The lead investigator, Massachusetts State Police Trooper Michael Proctor, admitted he sent a series of sexist and offensive texts about Reed, the suspect, in a private group chat. These included calling her a whack job and telling coworkers that he found, no, I think he even told his supervisor, he found no nudes while searching her phone. The prosecution called this behavior unprofessional, indefensible, inexcusable, but added it doesn't speak to the integrity of the investigation. Now, Proctor also acknowledged that he was friends with members of the Albert family. He was passing on like some details of the case to family members, and he was, you know, on these kind of chat rooms online. For instance, when the event first happened, someone said, "Wow, the homeowner is will receive some S for this." You know, made a comment, right. "Will receive the S." And Proctor's response was, "Nope, homeowner is a Boston cop too." And I don't know, there were things like that. So I guess my question to you is, the prosecution saying this doesn't speak to the integrity of the investigation, but you and I have talked about this a lot, Mark, where it comes to perception. At what point, when this stuff is going on, does it actually have the effect of harming the investigation, of being something that the jury is going to look at and say, I cannot trust this guy. He did these things. How do I know he's telling the truth?
Yeah, a couple of things here. First of all, I don't blame the jury for not trusting him. I'm not saying that the trooper didn't do everything by the book as far as the investigation. But like you said, the appearance or perception is very powerful that he may have manipulated facts. Mm-hmm. He may have or manipulated evidence. He may have not been completely truthful on the stand. But here's some more important aspect of this. We know that he had a personal relationship with the Alberts, mm-hmm. family involved there, the house. There's just no question about that. That's admitted. We know that he sent these various disparaging texts about the defendant. Even before those texts, though, knowing that he had a long-standing personal relationship with this family that's involved in the case, I certainly hold him accountable, but I don't put the blame on him. The blame goes to the department, to the State mm-hmm. Department. That's where the blame goes. You aren't investigating, you're putting one of your people on a murder case to investigate, and you either don't take the time to vet him to make sure, hey, do you have any personal relationship or is there any conflict of interest or things like this? Or you find out about it, you know about it, you're aware about it. And I can almost guarantee you that if this guy was sending texts to about the defendant and people, there are a lot of people in the department who knew about his relationship with people who were very close to the case. Mm-hmm. And the department let this go anyway. This is where mistrust of law enforcement happens. It's not so much at the rank and file level when cops screw up, and the cops do screw up, but it's when you find out that an agency is either encouraging this type of behavior or they are allowing this type of behavior. And either one leads to mistrust in law enforcement. In this case, mistrust in the prime investigator.
And Mark, leave it to my old employer, the U.S. Department of Justice, right? So I guess I'm not really clear. They opened an investigation into this, into the police handling of it. And I guess it was just due to public outcry. There was one particular internet news personality or blogger that was covering this case, and it was attracting a ton of attention. And the Department of Justice came in. And here's the thing that I found interesting about their involvement. Two expert witnesses hired by the Department of Justice during the investigation of the police handling testified for the defense, providing a scientific analysis for their conclusions that O'Keefe's injuries and the physical evidence didn't sync with the prosecution theory. So there are two Department of Justice supposedly experts are saying that the damage to the car and the damage or the injuries to O'Keefe's body were not consistent, that it could not have happened the way the police said it did. And again, these are government officials, federal government officials who were brought in to give this case the smell test, so to speak.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think
I guess from an accident, let me ask you this, from an accident reconstruction standpoint, is it one of those things, Mark, where you're kind of in your mind when you're doing this, you have some surety percentage, like you're saying, oh, I'm like 80% sure this is what happened, or is it kind of like all or nothing when you reconstruct an accident where you have this theory and you say, this is definitely what happened?
Well, you know, of course it depends. There's certainly, and by the way, and again, I did traffic accident investigation, like you said, and some other criminal investigation, but primarily traffic accident investigation. And I would say in the vast majority of cases, it's pretty clear based on evidence. And by the way, witness statements and involved party statements. You know, a lot of times you'll have, you know, three cars involved in an accident. It could be a very major accident. And every person, and to their credit, you know, in other words, the party at fault, every person involved will give you essentially the same statement, will give you the same version of what happened. And so, including the person who puts himself at fault. And so when you have that lined up with physical evidence and then witness statements all come together, there's just very, very little room for question in your mind. That's not 100% consistent or, you know, accurate. You have times where it can be very sketchy. You're not 100% sure. You're pretty much sure what happened. You have to put down what your opinion is. By the way, in the traffic accident investigations, it's called your opinions. It's not fact. Your opinion is just that. Here is what I believe happened. Because there are going to be other people. There are going to be civil courts, civil juries. There are going to be reconstruction experts from insurance companies who are also going to look at the witness statements, the evidence that you provided. They may come to a different conclusion. So that's why in the Highway Patrol, we put down, here's what my opinion as Officer Garrett is it happened. And usually it's right. Sometimes I wasn't right. So the fact that you're having the federal government here come back in, kind of reinvestigate and blah, 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 and they may be contradictory to what the original investigation said or, you know, or implied or indicated, it's not surprising to me. And there's something wrong, you know, with that in this case where there are a lot of questions. So, you know, this is why you have juries, because they have to look at the totality of it and come to a decision as best they can.
Yeah. I mean, two things that kind of, I thought, well, very strange about the case. The first was the injuries on his arm. Did you see the injuries on his arm?
Yes.
So I think we'll talk about that in a minute, but I thought the injuries on his arm were strange. And hey, I've never seen, you know, victims of a car accident really like you have to look at that and say, or anyone, I shouldn't say victims of a car accident. I should say someone who was struck by a car. That's probably the more accurate way to put this.
Either
and by the
fine.
Way, when you talked about a traffic invest, that's really what this is. You know, this really is, the allegation is that a vehicle was used to commit a murder. And,
right.
You know, so it is in essence, a traffic thing. He was missing one shoe and his hat, right? I thought that was very strange. And here's something that's, it could be resultant of the weather. I don't know. Detective Sergeant Michael Lank, he's Canton PD. So he's the police department, the local jurisdiction city police department there. He's a childhood friend of Chris Albert, the brother of the homeowner where this happened, who's the Boston police officer. He got on February 4th. So that's several days after this happened. What is that? Like five, six days after this happened, he gets a call from his chief, the chief of police of the Canton Police Department. And he's told to go back to the crime scene and pick up additional evidence. It was a piece of red glass near where the body was. And he says, hey, I got there, I photographed it in place, I didn't touch it, and I called the state police, and they came and recovered it. But you know, hey, like I said, it could be resulting of the weather. I know this is winter time in Massachusetts. Was it covered up by snow and no one saw it until the snow melted? I don't know. But when there's allegations of the type being made here, and then all of a sudden, you know, somehow the chief is involved and he's calling the childhood friend of this guy, and that guy's going and finding evidence that was supposedly there for 5 days and no one saw on the front yard. Where do you come out on that one?
Well, look, from a credibility point of view, and really from an investigation point of view, which are very close related, of course, it's troubling, Bill. Yeah. It's very troubling. Now, again, it's not the first time. Certainly, it's not the last time that evidence is recovered hours or days or years after the crime has been committed. So that's not unusual. What's unusual, or certainly I think is inappropriate, is the correspondence within the department about this. And again, them knowing the relationship with this detective and the state trooper, with the Albert family, this is the problem. In other words, and again, I want to be careful here because I'm not in the business of bad mouthing, you know, law enforcement agencies, just, you know, it just wholesale. But I will say this, that, you know, this is a small department. They are kind of admittedly not used to these types of investigations. Normally turn these investigations over to the state police. And I think that if you're not used to and trained in and kind of honed by repetition for these types of investigation, you can do things that even if they're not intentional or they're not nefarious, they certainly are inappropriate. And these types of communications between supervisors and people outside the department, people in the department, they bring a lot of, you know, lack of credibility to the investigation. I think it's what happened here. So, but again, retrieving evidence days after, especially in this type of inclement weather, that part's not unusual. It doesn't bother me. It's the fact of how they went about it and how it was type of kind of under the table, so to speak. That bothers me.
Right. So I guess the thing to talk about, Mark, is the injuries that he had. It looked, I don't know, how would you characterize what happened? I know. So let me say this. The defense says that the injuries to his arm, which almost looked like slicing injuries, were resultant of dog bites. And, you know, who knows, right? I can't look at that. I can't look at that.
Call a dog whisperer.
Yeah. But their theory is that he was beat up inside the house. The family did have a German Shepherd. They say that the dog attacked him too. They dumped his body in the front yard, and you know, and that's what happened. So since the incident happened, the family did get rid of the dog, which I thought was strange, but it, you know, maybe not, right? Maybe not. Interesting. They put the house up for sale. They say they were planning to at trial. Their testimony was they had actually contacted the real estate agent before this ever happened. And either way, that has nothing to do with the facts of that night, in my opinion. Right.
I agree.
Yeah. And the only other interesting thing I saw is, you know, the DA said cell phone. This is what I saw as a quote, and I take issue with this. The DA says cell phone data shows the phone never entered the house. And I'm not sure how they would, you know, I know quite a bit about cell phone tracking and everything. And yeah, unless you were there real time with a device to track the phone, I'm not really sure how you could make that distinction unless he was found, you know, 100 yards from the house. But him just being in the front yard, I mean, extremely difficult to pinpoint that and say he was never in the house. The only other thing I'll add, Mark, is I see that Proctor, the state police investigator, was relieved of duty after the trial, after the mistrial came, and they said that, now, of course, as always, Mark, as always happens in these cases, the DA comes out right away and says, we're going to retry the person. And you and I both know, maybe, maybe not. You know, they're going to look at it. And of course, they say that to kind of save face initially. But I'm reading that if Proctor testifies, it would be as a civilian. It would not even be as a law enforcement officer. So do you think, and I know we don't have the transcripts to see, you know, exactly what went on, but how does the case go forward without the lead investigator if he's relieved of duty and he's testifying as a civilian? Does he even testify?
Yeah, well, it's one of the problems, one of the boxes they put themselves in. The prosecution, not so much prosecution, is only dealing with the evidence and the investigators that are kind of, you know, thrown at them, so to speak. But certainly the state troopers, they allowed this to happen. So it doesn't go forward without that trooper, whether he's still a sworn officer or as a civilian. Now, I say it doesn't go forward. It possibly could. But of course, if you don't bring him back on, he's just going to get subpoenaed by the defense anyway. And they're just going to they're going to tear him up in court about, he lied about this. He sends these text messages, things like this. He becomes he becomes a hostile defense witness, is what he becomes. But I do think that my guess is it will be retried. Maybe they say, listen, we're going to retry this second degree murder, or you have the option of pleading out to a misdemeanor manslaughter, something like that. My guess is that they're not going to let it go. Right. Again, it's a very, very difficult situation now because of the lack of credibility from the law enforcement side on this one, specifically this one trooper and the detective, Link as well. But I want to say something about the injuries, about, you know, and of course, this ties into the whole conspiracy about, you know, he was killed in the house. He was dragged out, left in the snow. You would think that there would be an abundance of forensic evidence in the house, especially if the defense is claiming that he was mauled by a dog in the house. There would be tissue, there would be blood, there would be hair fibers. I'm only imagining there would be an abundance of evidence in the house that, you know, somebody didn't retrieve, but it would still be there today. Number one. Number two, one thing I am familiar with is the dynamics involving motor vehicle accidents. Yeah. And the dynamics are really, unless you have been around, you know, thousands of traffic accidents like I have been, it's very hard to describe how bizarre things can end up. I'm talking physically, bodies, Not to be terribly graphic here, body parts, vehicle intrusion, where vehicles end up, damage to stationary objects, trees, concrete walls, you know, center divider, K railing, things like this that you think would not move, or be destroyed. It's a very, very intriguing reality that the dynamics involved in motor vehicle accidents is tremendous. So including injuries. And one thing you talked about, I read about too, and when I read it, oh yeah, that makes sense, about the shoe being off. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that happen a lot when you have vehicle versus, we call automobile versus pedestrian, these autoped accidents. And one of the most fascinating dynamics is often people will be knocked out of their shoes. I mean, literally, now they were hit, you know, very high speeds, you know, at 40, 50 miles an hour, and they literally come out of their shoes. You'll see a pair of tennis shoes or a tennis shoe in the middle of the freeway or the middle of an intersection, and the body can be 30 feet away, 40 feet away. Now, in this case, it's alleged that she, you know, backed over him at 20-something miles an hour, which is a substantial impact from a 4,000 pound vehicle, whatever it is. And not only being knocked out of a shoe, but of course, if a body is tumbling or it's caught, you know, under a tire or things like this, that shoes and articles of clothing can be torn, can be stripped from the body as well. So that made total sense to me. That lined up historically, as far as my experience, with an autoped, you know, accident. And by the way, I'll be careful of that because it's not an accident. If the allegations are true, it would be an intentional act, not a traffic accident. This would be murder, by use of a motor vehicle. So anyway, that's my two cents on that. The injuries here are as consistent with any number of traffic accidents that I've investigated.
Yeah. And that's important to hear. That's interesting. Let's see where this case goes. I mean, the one thing I do know is perception. You know, perception becomes important. And there were things that, hey, everyone, all the law enforcement officers involved in this, I'm sure would do things very differently. And by the way, Mark, you mentioned earlier, about this being a small department, et cetera. And that's not, just so people know, like, that's not uncommon. I know here in L.A., there's a ton, 53 municipalities in L.A. County or something like that? You would know, right?
It's close actually, I want to say it's 70-something, I believe.
70-something?
And I believe. You could be right. I should know. I've forgotten.
Many of them have their own police departments, right? But if it comes to a homicide, they contract with the county sheriffs to handle the homicide investigation. Why? Because they're experienced. They do it every day. They have more resources, et cetera. So, yeah, that's, so some of the evidence collection and everything else, I don't know that it was done, the way they would do it if they had to do this over again. But also, that doesn't necessarily, that happens frequently. And that shouldn't be something that people look at and say, immediately there's some kind of corruption or conspiracy going on here.
Correct.
We've only scratched the surface on this one, Mark. I would love people to drop a note in the comments. There's people that watch this that are gonna be a lot more versed on. We saw this with when we talked about the Peterson case.
Yes,
people are going to be a lot more versed than we are on this, a lot more knowledgeable about it. Drop us a comment and let us know where you sit with it and what some of the key points are that caused you to form your opinion. And then, I don't know, maybe if this case gets filed again, Mark, or when it gets filed again, we'll come back and take a second look at it, or at least pay attention to how it goes through. Anything else to add?
No, it's a fascinating case. I mean, my personal opinion, I have it. I think it's kind of cut and dry, but I can also appreciate why the jury may have hung on this. So I'll leave it at that for maybe next time.
Yeah, and I would say, just to kind of add off that, I think had the victim not been a police officer, I think there would have been a guilty verdict in this. And I also think that probably if the genders were reversed, I also think there would have been, just my opinion, I think there probably also would have been a jury verdict in this. I think a lot of things outside of the actual evidence were taken into consideration besides the jury. And that resulted in them not being able to come to some consensus. Thanks for listening, folks.
Absolutely agree with you.
Yep. Thanks for watching. Like, share, and subscribe. And if you're listening on Apple, Apple iPod app or Spotify or something, go over and find us on YouTube and subscribe to us there. A lot of little tidbits come out during the week, and you will probably find them enjoyable. Thanks for tuning in.